Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, we're going to drop in on two more states in the run-up to the midterms, Wisconsin and Florida. But first, the story that everyone's talking about and is being politicized. It's also made many of us aware of a phrase that's well-known in many rural areas, pay to spray. We're talking about fee-based firefighting in unincorporated parts of the country that don't have tax-supported fire departments, residents can pay a fee to ensure coverage. Gene Cranick of Obion County, Tennessee, says he forgot to pay the $75 fee to the city of South Fulton. When a legal trash fire got out of hand, he called 911 and said he'd pay any amount. But firefighters stood by while his house burned to the ground, killing three dogs and a cat trapped inside. And they only sprang into action when the fire threatened Cranick's next-door neighbor, who had paid the fee. Listen to talk radio, and you'll hear callers say Cranick, again, who didn't pay, got what he deserved. They compare him to illegal immigrants and welfare recipients. Conservative host Glenn Beck calls not paying a free ride.
Your neighbor is sponging off of your $75.
And as soon as they put out the fire of somebody who didn't pay the $75,
no one
will pay the $75.
Why would you?
But here's left-leaning Keith Olbermann's response.
This is what they want, freeloaders and sponges, to be made examples of.
Well, joining us from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Jonathan Cohn, senior editor for The New Republic and author of its Citizen Cohn blog. And Jonathan, start with just some of the questions, the practical questions people have about this. Is it reasonable for a fire department to say you can't pay the fee at the scene because then no one would pay in advance and the department wouldn't have the resources they need? That's a point that Glenn Beck makes.
Well, you know, I get the logic there. I mean, it makes sense, right? I mean, if you're going to make, if the system is people have to pay, and then if you don't pay, the fire department shows up and they put your fire out anyway, why would anybody pay? I mean, I don't really agree with Glenn Beck on most things. I don't really agree with him all the way on this. But, you know, that part of the argument makes sense to me.
Well, but then some people are saying, you know, what about doing what other cities do? Now, we have become well aware that there are other cities, even when they have tax-based services, are adding fees on top of the service for auto accident extrication, for extinguishing some negligent fires, for ice and water rescues. In other words, even if there is a tax-based fire or police service, they're adding fees on top of that, but they're charging them after the fact. So what about the argument that you put the house fire out and then charge someone maybe four times the fee?
Right. Well, I mean, I think this gets to more what I think is sort of the ideal solution here. And it's something, it's an analogy I made to health insurance reform, which is that in this case, everyone should have to pay for fire protection. You have a house, you have to pay for fire protection, and everybody has to pay for it. Now, if you, for some reason, opt out of that and you decide not to pay for it, well, you know, and you have a fire, they're going to put out your fire because, you know, realistically, we don't want firefighters standing there while fires burn. We're going to go ahead and put it out, but then you will have to pay for it. And by the way, if you decided you opted out for some reason, you didn't want to pay for your fire protection, well, you know, we're going to make you pay a little extra now because you didn't pay your fair share in the first place.
Well, in fact, aren't you also, and again, and in drawing an analogy to healthcare, saying that if you opt not to get the coverage, you will pay a penalty up front, even before a fire?
Absolutely. I mean, my basic position on this is the following, is that I think realistically there are certain protections, there are certain services that as a society we should provide to everybody, and we expect everybody to be provided with. You know, we don't give people the right to opt out of police coverage, right? I mean, you have to pay for the police. You pay it through your taxes, but you have to pay for the police. Everybody has to pay into Social Security because we think, you know what, we want everybody when they get to be past the age of 65 to have a pension, to have a security. So we tell everyone, you have to pay into Social Security. And it's the same principle here. What we're basically saying is that everybody has to pay for this. Because realistically, you know, the sort of extreme libertarian position, the Glenn Beck position, right? Well, just let the house burn. Well, we're not going to let the house burn because, you know what, it's cruel.
But they did.
Well, they did. I mean, I know. And it's sort of, we're all shocked by it, or a lot of us. I'm shocked by it, at least. You know, I don't want to live in a society where we let that house burn. I don't want to live in a society where people need police help and can't get it. I don't want to live in a society where people get sick and then they have enormous medical bills and they go bankrupt. And the reason is simple. People make mistakes. You know, this guy says he forgot to pay the bill. You know, and we can all say, well, you know, that's his own problem. Well, okay, I don't mind making people live with the consequences of their decisions within reason, but it seems to me that the penalty for forgetting to pay the fire bill shouldn't be losing your entire house.
Well, it's amazing how much play this story has gotten and where it's taken us. Conservatives like David Foster writing in the National Review, he's writing, this is bad for libertarians, of course, with their less government call. Left-leaning columnist Joshua Holland, writing on Alternate, reminds us that this is a throwback to the days when private fire departments did directly sell insurance to homes, and they would only fight fires on homes that had decals, and that was a disaster. So I'm just wondering, do you think that this is something that's had it's having a blip and will pass, or do you think this will actually impact the national conversation?
You know, I wonder if maybe this is going to tap into something and maybe get us talking about these very fundamental issues. I mean, the funny thing is, you know, between the debate about health care reform and the debate about Social Security, and in general this debate about taxes and the government, this underlying issue of what obligations do we have for each other, what, you know, to what extent do we want to protect people from misfortune, and how do we pay for that, and how much should all of us have to pay for that? These issues are kind of been bubbling under the surface. Maybe this... You know, the problem is they get very complicated quickly. You're talking about health care reform. It's got all the mind-numbing details. You're talking about taxes and government. This fire actually crystallizes those issues in a very vivid way that people can identify with, and also, I think, in a very simple way that really gets at the basic questions here.
And by the way, an irony, Obion County, where the fire took place, they had a resolution to establish a countywide fire department that would cover everyone. It was tabled, and their own officials wrote in a recent report, because it was tabled, they missed the opportunity to get FEMA money and some grants. And also, to get that countywide service would have meant only raising property taxes 13 cents per person.
Yeah, well, you know, that doesn't surprise me. And the irony is, once you get into these debates on a policy level, it's often the case that, you know, you have a penny-wise, pound-foolish situation. You know, it turns out, for example, that, you know, giving everybody health insurance, there's a lot of ways that saves money, right? Because people are getting routine preventative care. They don't show up at the emergency room. And I'm sure over the long run, you can make a case that having countywide fire protection, that's better for the development, the health, the economy of that county than having this sort of patchwork system where, you're calling up the fire department saying, I have a fire, and someone's going through the records. Okay, is this guy, did he pay his bills? Did he not pay his bills? I mean, you think about it, it's kind of insane.
Jonathan Cohn, senior editor for The New Republic, author of its Citizen Cohn blog, speaking from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there is less than a month to go until the midterm elections. Let's touch down today in two states and see what they're talking about, if not fire fees. In a moment, we'll go to Wisconsin, where incumbent Democratic Senator Russ Feingold is behind in the polls to political newcomer Ron Johnson. But first to Florida. The big races are for U.S. Senate and governor, although a congressional race in the Orlando area is getting a lot of attention. Adam Smith is political editor for the St. Petersburg Times. Adam, let's start with that congressional race. You've got freshman Congressman Alan Grayson, a Democrat, calling his Republican opponent Daniel Webster Taliban Dan, because in a speech, Webster said he claims that Webster said wives should obey their husbands. Here's Democrat Grayson's ad.
Religious fanatics try to take away our freedom in Afghanistan, in Iran, and right here in Central Florida.
Wives, submit yourself to your own husband.
Daniel Webster wants to impose his radical fundamentalism on us.
She should submit to me.
But here we have some tape, Adam, of what Webster actually said. He was speaking to men, and he was recommending that they pick biblical verses to share with their wives, but...
Write a journal. Find a verse. I have a verse for my wife. I have verses for my wife. Don't pick the ones that say she should submit to me.
Adam Smith, Webster went on to say, let the wife, if she wants to, pick one that says that she should submit to you. What's your take on
Wasn't
Grayson's
that charming?
Ad? Well,
Alan Grayson is an in-your-face kind of politician, and it's why he's loathed by a lot of Republicans. He's sort of the Michelle Bachmann of Florida.
Michelle Bachmann being the very conservative Republican.
Yeah, another sort of bomb thrower who outrages the left. Grayson, by all accounts, is in significant trouble. He's a flamboyant guy, and Daniel Webster is just exactly the opposite, very subdued, very mellow, a longtime legislator.
Well, look, Democrats are saying they want their candidates to hit hard. They feel that they're not hitting back at what they see as huge Republican attacks. And they say, you know, the Republican Webster may have been taken out of context on that occasion. Again, he didn't tell men to tell their wives to submit to them. But on other occasions, for instance, he sponsored a bill for covenant marriage in Florida, which would have limited divorce to just adultery. So, you know, does Grayson have to go at him on conservative issues?
Well, I think you could certainly raise the questions about Webster's record in the legislature, where he was very much of a social conservative, although he had a lot of admirers in the Democratic Party who were suspicious of his religious views initially and found that he was not especially overbearing in the legislature. But it's another thing to compare somebody to a terrorist like the Taliban.
Yeah. Okay, well, putting the congressional race aside, let's take a look at the gubernatorial, rather the Senate race, a major televised debate taking place tonight in the three-way race. Governor Charlie Crist running as an independent after leaving the Republican Party. Remember, it looked like he would lose the Republican primary to Marco Rubio. The Democrat in the race is African-American Kendrick Meek. So first of all, what's the jockeying in that race right now?
Marco Rubio is the clear front runner. There's some recent polls that show it tightening, but it looks essentially like a two-person race, largely between Charlie Crist and Marco Rubio. And the trick for Charlie Crist is he's trying to win a lot of Democrats. So he's facing he and Kendrick Meek are kind of battling for the same group of voters in many respects.
Well, and Kendrick Meek and the Democratic Party are hammering away at Charlie Crist in campaign ads, probably with that in mind, trying to use his own words against him. Let's listen.
I'm as bad as conservative as you can get. I'm a Jeb Bush Republican.
President Bush, he is a leader of courage and conviction.
I was impressed that Governor Palin being picked. I watched her speech today. I was very impressed.
Charlie Crist's words in a Kendrick Meek ad, do you think it's hitting?
I think it's pretty devastating, and it's certainly 100% accurate. But right now, it looks like Kendrick Meek is really struggling for traction. He doesn't have a lot of money because he had a very tough primary against a billionaire, and you know, most of the polls show him within the teens. And Charlie Crist is winning a majority of Democrats and independents in the latest polls.
Well, and let's take a look briefly. Coming up to a break, we'll take a break and come back on the other side with Adam Smith of the St. Petersburg Times. But you know, Marco Rubio came out very strongly against the tough immigration reform law in Arizona. But we're reading that Hispanics are lukewarm on coming out in this election. That's supposed to be bad for Democrats across the country. How will it impact Rubio in Florida?
Well, actually, Rubio did not come out very strongly against the Arizona. He really waffled quite a bit and took.
You're right. He was against it before, and he waffled.
He was sort of everywhere, but he finally is saying he doesn't think that would be appropriate for Florida. I do think, you know, he is a Cuban American. He's got a family that came from Cuba. His parents. So I think he will get a good amount of Hispanic support.
Well, Adam Smith, a political editor for the St. Petersburg Times. We want to continue to look at some of the races in Florida. But after that, we'll go to Wisconsin, where a candidate, you know, this again is cheesehead territory, has been slapped by the NFL. We'll take a look in Wisconsin. But back with the gubernatorial race in Florida with Adam Smith in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our weekly look at the midterm elections. We've been talking with Adam Smith, political editor for the St. Petersburg Times. Lots of exciting races there in Florida. And Adam, we just want to touch down on the governor's race. We have the Democrat, Alex Sink. She's a former president of Nations Bank Florida, and Republican Rick Scott. Just remind us who these candidates are.
This is a very unpredictable race. Alex Sink, her husband actually ran against Jeb Bush in 2002, Bill McBride, and she's always been viewed as sort of a potential star in the Democratic Party. She's running against somebody that nobody had heard of just a few months ago, Rick Scott, who is a multi-millionaire who's already spent more than $50 million of his own money and has a lot of baggage in his background. He was CEO of Columbia HCA, was pushed out of the company, which had to pay $1.7 billion in fines for Medicare fraud.
What's the sense of, you know, how that race is going?
It is wide open. I think, there is a Republican. Alex Hink, in many respects, is a very good candidate for Florida. She's not especially liberal. She's got a business background. She's, a Southerner from North Carolina, which we tend to like people with Southern accents in our statewide races for some reason. But she's, up against a Republican wave that's hitting Florida like everywhere else, and she's up against somebody that is spending huge money in trying to wrap Barack Obama's policies around her neck.
Adam Smith, political editor for the St. Petersburg Times, where it just sounds like an exciting time if you're into politics in the state of Florida.
Never dull in Florida with politics.
That's right. Adam, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, let's now turn to Wisconsin. Longtime Democratic Senator Russ Feingold is in the political fight of his life against newcomer Ron Johnson. And today in the land of cheeseheads, Feingold took some heat from the NFL for using footage without permission of a game in which Randy Moss showboats in the end zone after a touchdown.
And they're dancing in the end.
In pro football, they call this excessive celebration.
That is a disgusting act.
And they punish it with fines and 15-yard penalties.
And the crowd.
It's exactly the kind of behavior the corporate special interests and Ron Johnson are engaging in.
J.R. Ross covers politics for WispPolitics.com. And J.R., of course, today everyone where we are in New England is talking about how Patriot Randy Moss has been traded back to the Minnesota Vikings. But are people really, did this ad really backfire because of the NFL? I mean, how's this ad being received in Wisconsin?
Well, it's definitely set the blogosphere afire with conservatives jumping on Feingold. You know, why did he run this ad? Doesn't he know better? I mean, anybody who's watched an NFL game has seen or heard at least the disclaimer at every broadcast that says that you can't use the express written of the NFL, et cetera, et cetera. Feingold's a lawyer. Why does he know this? You know, it's just kind of a question of why would you make this kind of mistake in a campaign from a guy who's been running for most of his adult life for various offices.
Well, and that's why people in Wisconsin know him well. He's well known as a fierce defender of many liberal causes. He's been in the Senate since 1993. Give us a thumbnail on Ron Johnson, his opponent.
Ron Johnson's a guy who nobody had heard of just 7-8 months ago. He kind of came out of nowhere, an Oshkosh businessman, Packer Manufacturing, kind of a plastics company. Kind of cut his teeth a little bit in a Tea Party rally earlier this year, last fall, one of the two. Kind of started talking about running for U.S. Senate. So he says he was watching the healthcare debate and says the last straw and decided to run. And the thing about it is he has a lot of money to run. That's why people are interested in him. That's why he's doing so well. He's been able to blanket Wisconsin Airways with ads starting late spring. That's really kind of put his name out there. And he went from being a nobody to announcing like in April to in May getting the endorsement of the Republican Party of Wisconsin to being tied with Feingold in a matter of weeks. It's been kind of impressive the way he's come out of nowhere and become a legitimate threat. And now he's even leading some polls by double digits over Feingold.
Well, some should say that we should say that not all Tea Party organizations back him. Some members of the Rock River Patriots said they were unimpressed with his knowledge of the Constitution. They had a quiz for him. But there you go. And I'm wondering, the ad that Russ Feingold put out, what we're hearing is that across the board, Democrats have an enthusiasm gap. They can't seem to get voters interested in the midterms. Is that what's happening in Wisconsin, or is it more they know Russ Feingold and are rejecting him?
Well, if you look at some of the polls, you see the biggest enthusiasm gap anywhere in Wisconsin compared to other states, and it's really hitting Feingold hard. And the thing is, with Feingold, you remember this, he is known for a couple of things, campaign finance reform being one of them, voting against the Patriot Act be another. But if you look at his career, where does he hang his hat in terms of, fixing the economy, in terms of economic issues? And those are the things that, people are trying to look for in this time is, what's Feingold done for me lately? And he's always built a reputation as being a fiscal hawk of, I oppose wasteful spending. But that's been undercut in some ways by the votes for health care reform and for the stimulus package. I mean, he did oppose TARP, but people are getting going, well, Russ, how does this jive with this reputation you have? And Ron Johnson has really done a very good job of capitalizing upon that, hitting Feingold time and time again, as this is a guy who's voted for health care reform. He voted for the stimulus. It's not working. He's a wasteful spender. This is not the Russ Feingold you've known and loved for all these years, Wisconsin. This is a different kind of guy.
Take a quick look at the governor's race with you. Democratic Governor James Doyle decides not to seek reelection. You've got Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett, the Democrat in the race, facing Republican Scott Walker. He's the executive of Milwaukee County. How's that race playing out briefly?
Well, what's fascinating is that back in April-ish, when Tommy Thompson, the former governor, decided not to run against Russ Feingold, the assumption around Wisconsin was, well, Russ Feingold is doing really well to pull Tom Barrett across the finish line in the governor's race. Now it's the opposite. Tom Barrett's in a much better position than Feingold is. The polls you're seeing in the governor's race have him down single digits, you know, anywhere from 1 point to 7, kind of in that neck of the woods. You've very much got these two guys who are Milwaukee politicians, which is unusual in Wisconsin. Usually Milwaukee politicians don't do well in statewide races, but the voters don't have a choice this time. It's all about Milwaukee, and it's become a clash of Milwaukee issues. You know, basically Tom Barrett saying, Scott Walker, you've run Milwaukee County on the ground, and Scott Walker saying, Tom Barrett, you've run Milwaukee on the ground. So it's kind of this back and forth of who's been a worse manager of Milwaukee, essentially.
Well, and this is as Milwaukee is facing some tough times. You know, we've been reporting on Harley Davidson, you know, talking about leaving.
Yes, they are actually going to stick around now. They've reached some labor deals. But, you know, I mean, it's like any state that I've lived in. The biggest city is always the one that people out state hate because they view it as a place that sucks resources away from the rest of the state.
J.R. Ross of WisPolitics.com. Ending our wrap-up this week, we took a look at Wisconsin, Florida before that. And, J.R., just as I say goodbye to you, also say hello to my Aunt Ruth and Uncle Dick in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin.
Will do.
And, J.R., thanks so much.
Anytime.
Back after the latest news, here and now. After an easy stroll for some teams and a mad dash for others, Major League Baseball's second season gets underway today, the one that counts, the playoffs. 8 clubs vying for a ticket to the World Series 2 weeks from now. Here's the lineup. In the American League, it's the New York Yankees versus the Minnesota Twins, the Tampa Bay Rays against the Texas Rangers. In the National League, the Philadelphia Phillies take on the Cincinnati Reds, and the San Francisco Giants face the Atlanta Braves. And joining us to talk about their chances is Ted Keith, baseball editor for Sports Illustrated. So let's just jump right in. Texas, Tampa Bay, key to that series.
Pitching, pitching, and pitching. It's going to be Cliff Lee of the Rangers against David Price of the Rays today in Game 1, probably the best pitching matchup we're going to get in any of the 3 rounds. Lee was phenomenal last year for the Phillies and is basically the type of pitcher who can carry a team a long way all by himself. The key is going to be, can the Rangers get enough help from their other pitchers to upset the Rays, who are probably the best team in the American League, if not all of baseball?
Okay, now turning to the team, a Red Sox fan, it just really annoys the heck out of us to have to say it, but here you have the New York Yankees versus the Minnesota Twins. And with apologies to our friends in Minnesota, you know, the Yankees really have dominated the Twins in postseason play, winning 9 of their 11 first-round meetings. So is that just going to continue?
More so than that, I think, is the fact that the Yankees have beaten them 14 out of 16 times they've played in the past 2 seasons.
Ouch.
And that includes a sweep last year in the first round of the playoffs. So it's recent history that's really going to be weighing on the Twins' mind. They are a better team than they were last year. They're a deeper team. They have a better, more well-rounded bullpen. But they are missing Justin Morneau, their left-handed first baseman and one of their best power hitters. And they are missing Joe Nathan. They've been without him, their top closer, all year long. They will have home field advantage in this series, but it's overcoming that recent history of knowing that no matter what they do, the Yankees have beaten them almost every time.
Okay, so you say advantage New York in that round and advantage Tampa Bay in the Texas-Tampa Bay matchup. Let's look at the National League. Both the Giants and the Braves kind of hobbled into the playoffs. Who has the stamina to make it to the next round?
I would think the Giants do because the Braves are dealing with a lot of injuries right now. Chipper Jones, their longtime third baseman, has been out since August. Martin Prado, one of their best hitters, has been out. He won't be back for the playoffs. And on the other side, the Giants have pitched better than any other team down the stretch in September, and they have 3 terrific starters all lined up and ready to go. While as the Braves' rotation is not quite as settled, they're starting Derek Lowe, who pitched great in September, but their ace is actually Tim Hudson. He won't go until Game 3. So this series could be all but over by the time Hudson even gets the ball in Atlanta in Game 3.
Oh, boy. Well, and that might be the case in the one last matchup. This also in the National League. And again, with apologies, this time to our friends in Cincinnati. You know, the Philadelphia Phillies are expected to sweep the Cincinnati Reds in 3 games. Do you buy into that conventional wisdom?
I do. It's just that they're going to have an overwhelming pitching advantage in every matchup. They have the home field advantage. Their only pitcher who they're going to be throwing out who does not have a stellar postseason resume is Roy Halladay, and he might be the best pitcher in all of baseball. And so when you've got 3 guys like Roy Halladay, Roy Oswalt, and Cole Hamels pitching for you, there aren't maybe 3 other pitchers in baseball combined who you would feel good about running out against them, much less from one team. And with all due respect to the Reds, they had a terrific season to get to the playoffs for the first time in 15 years. I think everyone's expecting it to be a short stay.
So what we're hearing here, Ted Keith, is that, you know, everybody should stay home but the pitchers in the playoffs.
It it's always going to be about pitching in October. Who has the most, especially the starting pitching, really takes on paramount importance. And that's what you saw last year. The Yankees won a World Series only having to start three guys all month. CeCe Sabathia, A.J. Burnett, Andy Pettit. The Phillies are a team that could potentially do that again this year. You know, even the Giants maybe could, although they have a very good fourth starter in Madison Bumgarner. It's just pitching is going to be what determines who wins the World Series.
So it sounds as if the key to the playoffs is, you know, pitching rotations and how managers handle them.
Right, exactly. It's going to be what do they get out of the guys that they use and when do they use them. As we get later into the playoffs, we're going to hear a lot of talk about guys maybe going on short rest. You know, they're used to pitching every fifth day with 4 days of rest in between. Now that might get moved up for some pitchers depending on the circumstances. And those things dramatically alter usually the way a pitcher performs because it's against their usual routine. And they're usually a little bit more tired than they would if they had full rest. So it's about not just who you have and how often you use them. Obviously, it's going to have something to do with who the other team is throwing out there and if their guy is going on full rest and shuts your team down. So it's kind of a chess match that plays out all month long.
Ted Keith, baseball editor for Sports Illustrated. Thank you.
Thank you.
A handful of Americans are stuck in limbo in Nepal. Now, they traveled there to complete adoption of Nepalese children. But literally, while the parents were flying to that country, the U.S. government changed its policy, banning the adoptions because of concerns about child trafficking. U.S. officials say the Nepalese system is corrupt, that there are fake documents, kidnappings, and they've launched an investigation. But caught in the middle are at least five Americans and the children they've adopted but can't bring home to this country. They include a single Chicago woman who runs her own PR firm. Candace Waltier has now been living in Kathmandu for 2 months with Antara, the daughter she's adopted with the permission of Nepalese officials. And Candace joins us on a Skype phone line. Candace, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
Well, is it true that you were literally on the plane? You'd gone through the adoption process for about 18 months. You were approved back in June and you were on the plane. And when you got off on the other side, heard the policy had changed?
Yes. You know, my adoption agency informed the U.S. Embassy that families were on their way. So the U.S. Embassy was well aware of the fact that families were on their way. And when I arrived, we were called to a meeting with the embassy and other officials. And that's when I learned that the program was suspended. It was an abrupt change to policy that we were unaware of.
What was your reaction when you're hearing this?
I mean, I was stunned. I was scared. And I didn't know what would happen. I'm actually still scared.
Well, I imagine you are. Now, just tell us, though, since February, the U.S. has been urging parents to reconsider adoptions from Nepal. And do you think you should have exercised more caution before you even went? I mean, you know, given that there were these warnings.
The State Department posted an alert on its website, as it has with numerous international adoption programs. However, they continued to state that they would not close the program down. Also, leading up to my arrival here, there were many families who came and adopted their children and were issued visas. All the cases were approved prior to our arrival. In fact, I have friends from the Chicago area who adopted children and were here for a matter of weeks. And that was just a few weeks before I came.
Well, another issue is that you can still go online today, and you can see a lot of adoption agencies offering to facilitate Nepali adoptions without any mention of a U.S. ban. So even now, when the U.S. has officially changed policy and has this investigation, you may not know that, and you may get involved with an adoption process.
Well, that's unfortunate. You know, my agency, Children's Home Society and Family Services, is based in Minneapolis, and I'm most certain that they're making their clients aware of the situation.
Right. To the other question, though, the U.S. has launched this investigation. Now, we've heard the same concerns about other international adoptions. In December, we spoke with a mother from California who worries that her daughter, adopted years ago from China, may not have been abandoned, as the mother was told. She's even thinking of taking her back someday to look for a mother who may be missing her after reports of corruption in the Chinese adoption system. There have also been reports about questions about Vietnam. Here you have this beautiful little girl now. Do you worry that she might have been taken from a mother that now misses her?
I believe that Antra is an orphan. There are 750,000 orphans here in Nepal. I would only want to be part of an ethical adoption program. And if I ever found out that through the investigation that both the Nepali government does as well as our U.S. government, a birth mother ever came forward and it was ever proven that that was the case, of course, you know, it would break my heart, but I would not want to be part of a program that was unethical or that something was wrong.
Well, what's it like now? You don't have the visa to bring her home, but you are formally her mom, living in an apartment with another woman from Massachusetts. What's going on in your head?
It's a nightmare. I've been here for 2 months. I'm a single mother. I pursued my dream of being a mother, and I'm here. I'm single. I'm all alone.
And we should say, when your story appeared in Mary Schmick's column in the Chicago Tribune, there were some readers who wrote in with, you know, some nasty comments about, you know, you should have adopted here. You did try as a single woman to adopt in the U.S., and it was very difficult.
I pursued my dream of being a mother. I looked at both domestic adoption as well as international adoption. To me, it didn't matter where my child was from, what color my child was. I was told by numerous agencies when I was doing my research that domestic adoption would be very, very difficult for a single person. So I focused my energy at that point on international adoption, and here I am. But, you know, for those people who say, look at, you know, I don't think they really understand.
Yeah. Well, meantime, are you bonding with Antara? Or what are you doing? I mean,
I absolutely am. She is the love of my life, and we are, and she calls me Mama, and I've seen her take her first steps at the orphanage. I spent a lot of time at the orphanage. I was really lucky that my mother traveled with me here, and she stayed for a month. She had to leave after a month because, you know, we have other responsibilities at home. But my mom was able to see her also take her first steps. We spend every moment together. I mean, in an odd way, it's a bit of a blessing, I guess, if I have to look at the bright side of things, because I am able to spend so much all of my time with her. I mean, I have no care. I have, it's just me and her. And I hear her say her first words, Mama. She says ball and bye-bye and stinky diaper.
Well, but how long do you think you can go on like this? And how long do you think you might have to?
The uncertainty is what makes this such a difficult situation to be in. I'm very scared that we haven't heard anything from our U.S. officials who are reviewing the files. It's been weeks. And I am urging them to expedite the process, especially for those families who are here and who have already adopted their children. And it's becoming very hard to be here. I don't know how long we will be here. That's uncertain.
But would you ever leave without her?
No, I won't leave Nepal without her.
That's 42-year-old Candace Waltier. She's adopted Andra, a Nepalese baby, and is stuck in Nepal because of a U.S. ban on Nepalese adoptions. Candace, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Author Ha Jin won both the National Book and Penn Faulkner Awards for his novel Waiting, which was based on his service in the Red Army in his native China. He left China in 1985 and is now a professor of English at Boston University. His latest collection of short stories straddles the two worlds, telling the tales of Chinese immigrants struggling to make their way in New York's Flushing, Queens. We meet a waitress financially tethered to a sister back home, the sister threatening to sell her organs if the waitress doesn't send her money. A visiting Chinese professor asks a former student to help him defect. The student knows the professor spent years doing hard labor on a chicken farm during the Cultural Revolution. How can the student say no? And then there are the Chinese grandparents who sell everything they own in China to come live with their son and his family in Flushing.
Our grandchildren hate us. The boy and the girl, ages 11 and 9, are just a pair of selfish, sloppy brats and have no respect for old people. Their animosity toward us originated at the moment their names were changed, about 3 months ago. One evening, the boy complained that his schoolmates couldn't pronounce his name, so he must change it. "Lots of them call me Chicken," he said. "I want a regular name like everyone else." His name was Qi Ganxi, pronounced qi gan he, which could be difficult for non-Chinese to manage.
A reading from Children as Enemies, one of the stories in Hajin's collection A Good Fall. It comes out in paperback later this month. We spoke with Hajin when the book was first published. The stories still stay with us, and we asked him then, where did they come from?
Most of the happenings in the story were known to the Chinese communities. They happened in different places.
So the stories were anecdotally told in the Chinese community?
Yes, and also some of them, in fact, were reported in community newspapers.
It was funny because we were remarking how often you mention the community newspapers in Flushing.
Yes.
Those are real.
Different names, but yes, there are many, many small newspapers.
So these were news reports in large part.
I would say maybe four or five of them, based on the kernels of the stories, are news reports.
Tell us of one that was based on a news report.
For instance, the home health aid story, that was reported several times. The articles described how these women underpaid, no benefits, no overtime pay, and they couldn't speak English.
And in your telling, it's a home health aide who's charged with taking care of a very elderly Chinese man.
Yes.
She can't speak English very well, and so she's not only sort of at the mercy of this elderly man who she's taken care of, who decides to fondle her, but his daughter as well, who is a few steps up on the immigration ladder, she speaks better English. So the home health aide is sort of in the clutches of both.
That is a very common story, in fact, from the earlier immigrant stories in American literature. For instance, in Villa Cathay, in her work, you come across Bohemian immigrants. You know, somebody could speak English and then would take advantage of other immigrants.
Is this Willa Cather?
Yes.
Yes, and in her writing, you read that as well?
Yeah.
Well, tell us, if this is an old universal story, what about it is uniquely Chinese?
I think there's a sense of a very strong, kind of well-knit community and these people really were controlled by others.
They're
controlled by others. And also I think there's intense isolation, although they live in the community. You have a sense that geographically there is a Chinatown there, but at the same time they are somehow really isolated.
Yeah.
And in that sense, I think they are very similar to other groups of immigrants, but it's just a matter of degree.
Give us another example of a story that just was something that you were aware of because it was happening in the Chinese community in Flushing.
There are many of the stories, I would say. They are immigrant stories, but at the same time, they are typical Chinese immigrant stories. For instance, in the story you mentioned, the professor wanted to defect, but then you have a sense, the homeland or the native land is looming behind as a huge power, still shadowed these people's lives.
We should say this professor had been visiting. He'd been at the Chinese consulate.
Yes.
and he now decides to defect. His wife is ill. He can't get medicines for her back home. So he goes to this student, and it is true that he suddenly feels as if, oh, no, now, the entire weight of the homeland is going to be bearing down on me if I protect this man.
Yes, yes.
What about you? I mean, how are any of these characters stand-ins for you?
Not really, but I might have given my personal experiences here and there to them, but I wouldn't say any of them really can stand for me. No, they can't. I'm different. I have had a very fortunate life by comparison.
How so? How would you?
I finished my graduate work. I began teaching soon after that. And also I have published several books, and I have very good family.
But some of your books have been very revealing about Chinese culture. I'm thinking of Waiting, for which you won the National Book Award. It tells of a couple yearning to be with each other, but they can't. They're waiting because of restrictions on them. Do you ever worry that the phone's going to ring and it's going to be a consulate or someone asking you about how you're portraying?
Oh, even if the phone didn't ring, sometimes the phone did ring, but there has been a lot of hostile words or negative criticism published in China. because I think the officials were behind that. I'm used to it. That's part of the price I have to pay.
Yeah. Explain Flushing, Queens. You visited first in 2005, found this wonderful, vibrant community, went back several times, and all the stories are set there. It's a wonderful place, Flushing. How would you explain it to...
It was like a town inside China, because there are so many immigrants, all the foods and the shop signs in Chinese characters. And in fact, a lot of Chinese and other immigrants would go there to do shopping, eating in restaurants on weekends.
Yeah.
So it's a really very important part of New York life, in fact.
Well, and at one time it was probably an Italian neighborhood and maybe a Jewish neighborhood.
Also Greek neighborhood, yeah. Yes. And Koreans, a lot of Koreans too, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a quick question to you. How much do you find yourself, I mean, here you are, you're so invested in this community, you don't have national awards. Your writing seems to have moved from characters in China to characters here, you know, primarily. Do you dream about China? Do you dream in Chinese? Do you still feel that tug?
Yeah, sure. But while I'm rational, very often I think in English. But
you think in English,
yeah,
too?
But yeah, but when I'm more emotional, sometimes Chinese would come up. And also I dream half and half in English and Chinese.
Huh. Bilingual dreamer. Do you want to go back?
To visit, yes, but to live would be very hard. I think because, again, it's the government is a big force, and it's very hard to enter that field of force, and then your life will be affected,
yeah,
shaped in a way.